day, I'm sure it is, in the fine mountains of Utah. Folks, we are live. Welcome back to episode 19 of To the Unknown Pod. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media. We exist to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. Today, we are not joined by Oshawa from Portland, but we are joined by a couple of the finest Presbyterians I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. So I'll let them introduce themselves.
I'm Tim Fox, executive director of the Magnolia Foundation. I'm a Presbyterian minister. At Magnolia, we're trying to orange pill the church, help churches and Christian ministries understand Bitcoin and hold on to it and use it.
And I am Jim McAndrew. I am a deacon in the Presbyterian Church in America with Tim. And I am a software developer, technologist, investor, entrepreneur, and I do tech support at Magnolia.
I think you need to chill. What's your day job? What's your other tech support job, Jim?
I run a company that is software for drones, but not the military industrial complex. It's dronelink.com.
Go check out Jim. Go find out what he does. It's very fascinating. Speaking of shilling, the first thing we're going to open up with is we have 4 days left, a mere 4 days. We are at 95% funded on our kids' book, The Orange Umbrella. We are thrilled to get this thing over the line. 2 years of work, way too long. We wrote the whole thing without AI. We illustrated the whole thing without AI. Found a fine, just Jesus-loving girl who just is an incredible artist and did this whole thing. So we are 117 backers. We are just under $600 away from our goal. We are super anxious and excited to get that over the line. So if you want to be the one who brings us past the $12,500 mark, that would be incredible. There's an abbreviated shill. We're going to stop the shilling right there because today we have something far more thrilling to talk about. And that is, man, did anybody else see this bonkers Peter Thiel, Ross Douthat interview? My word. I just could not believe it. For those of you who aren't aware, Peter Thiel, venture capitalist, one of the founders of PayPal, has money, one of the founders of Palantir, a number of other Lord of the Rings named businesses that are semi-dystopian, sat down for an interview with Ross Douthat, who's a New York Times contributor, famous Roman Catholic, really interesting guy. Go read his work. They sat down and had one of the most unhinged conversations that I've ever seen. So we're gonna talk about that. And that's why we call, you know, if you look at the title, you might be thinking to yourself, who in the world would not want the human race to continue, or who could have a doubt about whether or not they wanted the human race to continue? Well, my friends, apparently Peter Thiel does. Let's take a look at this video. Let me share this. Here we go.
You would prefer the human race to endure, right? You're hesitant.
Yeah, well,
yes?
I don't know. I would, there's so many questions.
Should the human race survive?
Yes.
Okay.
But I also would like us to radically solve these problems.
Right.
And so, you know, it's always, I don't know, you know, yeah, transhumanism is this, you know, the ideal was this radical transformation where your human natural body gets transformed into an immortal body. And there's a critique of, let's say, the trans people in a sexual context, or I don't know, transvestite is someone who changes their clothes and cross dresses. And a transsexual is someone where you change your penis into a vagina. And we can then debate how well those surgeries work. But we want more transformation than that. The critique is not that it's weird and unnatural. It's, man, it's so pathetically little. And we want more than cross-dressing or changing your sex organs. We want you to be able to change your heart and change your mind and change your whole body. And then Orthodox Christianity, by the way, the critique Orthodox Christianity has of this is these things don't go far enough. Like that transhumanism is just changing your body, but you also need to transform your soul. And you need to transform your whole self. And so,
right. But the other, wait. I generally
thank you, Ross.
Agree with your
what I think is your belief, that religion should be a friend to science and ideas of scientific progress. I think any idea of divine providence has to encompass the fact that we have progressed and achieved and done things that would have been unimaginable to our ancestors. But it still also seems like, yeah, the promise of Christianity in the end is you get the perfected body and the perfected soul through God's grace. And the person who tries to do it on their own with a bunch of machines is likely to end up as a dystopian character.
All right. Let's just let this breathe a little bit, okay? So again, they're sitting here talking about transhumanism. They're talking about what this looks like. And I mean, I'm sure you have just so many things that we could talk about, but I mean, what a wild thing that Peter Thiel has to think of how he wants to answer the question, do you want the human race to survive? And then to kind of start talking about, yes, we do want it to survive, but we want it to change in terms of we want to move transcending the body, then trying to ground that somehow theologically, which we haven't even gotten to that part yet. But Tim, help us make sense of this, please.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's the under duress, finally having to admit yes, but then says yes, but, and then goes on to talk about some really freaky deaky stuff in terms
of,
you know, it sounds like he's basically saying, well, yes, but only insofar as it is a preliminary stage to something better and something different.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, yeah, well, I guess I need to have humans so that we can get to the next thing and that's better. And then this really goofy kind of conflation of that with the Christian doctrine of resurrection, which is radically different than what he's talking about. But yeah, just, I don't know. I mean, it's in some ways, again, I don't know very much about Peter Thiel. I think he may profess to be a Christian in some form, but I mean, this idea is not, you know, totally unheard of, that humans don't deserve to survive or that they're a cancer on the earth. Or, I mean, in some ways, you know, people really don't like the Christian doctrine of original sin, that humans are born fundamentally sinful and twisted and under God's judgment. But in some ways, with things like this, there's a sort of recognition of the fact that there is something gross about humans and there's something wrong. And that, yeah, I don't know. I bet if you asked him, you know, do you think, you know, humans are under God's wrath? It'd probably be like, oh, no, you know, that's not very nice. Or, you know, most kind of contemporary people think that's really old fashioned to think that. But then to turn around and say, well, we shouldn't continue existing, in some ways is a kind of implicit recognition of something like the Christian doctrine of original sin, that something's wrong with us. Something is deeply wrong with us. But the Christian means something very different by that than what he's saying.
Yeah, I think a lot of the pushback too, it's like people pluck out the, okay, people are born into sin as if that was somehow the initial state. As if, like, why would God then, like, they just, people would object, like, why would God make a world where everyone's sinful? Like, they, and you're like, no. you have to actually have to read the first two chapters before that, where it's like, no, God didn't make a world where everyone, this wasn't God's, you know, initial design in a real sense, that we would, there would be a world of sin. And so it's just like, I've interacted with people who would raise that objection, and you're just like, but wait, you can't just cherry pick parts of the story and then just straw man them and beat them down. It's kind of like, no, you have to kind of see the full arc. And Peter here seems to, you know, be just kind of cherry picking and speaking in such a way that I can't speak to this, but like, what seemed to be, are you trying to defend? Are you like putting the cart before the horse? You're trying to, like, did you start with this presupposition, this misunderstanding of, you know, what the perfecting of human souls and perfecting of humanity, what this process is going to look like and who's going to do it? And that's why you're building these companies? Or are you trying to build these companies, you know, because you think that that's going to help some? I don't know. I'm just super confused as far as like, what is it? Who is influencing? He's really influenced by Girard, like Rene Girard. That's kind of, you can find articles online about how like he's talked about like the scapegoat, and he's like talked about a number of these things. He's a thoughtful guy. He's actually, if I'm not mistaken, he is a big funder of First Things, the journal First Things. I could be wrong, but for some reason I really think he is.
And Elon were both part of the PayPal mafia.
Yep.
A lot of these ideas come from that small group of guys that were early 2000s in the Bay Area.
Yep.
Elon has stated things like humanity is like a consciousness bootloader or an intelligence bootloader for the next iteration. I think what they kind of wave their hands and say, it's not really about the physical form, it's about consciousness. And they don't really define what consciousness is, but they just say it kind of takes one to know one, and consciousness is a good thing. And it would be horrible if, you know, we were the only light of consciousness in the universe and it got snuffed out, which is part of the reason why Elon is doing SpaceX, is because he wants to get us off this planet so consciousness doesn't get snuffed out. But the whole thing kind of falls apart, right? Because it's like, it can't really define what consciousness is or why it's special and how it can exist separate from an actual body that we've been given by a creator.
Yeah. Yeah. So Peter, he definitely funds First Things. First Things is like a very thoughtful Christian journal of articles. There's a bunch of good stuff in there. He's written a number of things. He's spoken about his faith. He's practicing homosexual on top of that. So it is this interesting, just a real interesting kind of eclectic thinker and in person in general. I mean, he was obviously been one of a large funder for conservative politics and conservative causes on to a certain degree, but then also is working towards transhumanism, which is, I mean, about as far from conservatism as you can imagine. Unless any of you have anything else, let's finish watching this little this other little clip where things get even more wild.
Likely to end up as a dystopian character.
Well, it's let's articulate this.
And you're going to have a heretical form of Christianity,
yeah,
right? That says something else.
I don't know. I think the word nature does not occur once in the Old Testament. And so, there is a word in which the way I understand, the Judeo-Christian inspiration is about transcending nature. It is about overcoming things. And the closest thing you can say to nature is that people are fallen. And that's the natural thing in a Christian sense is that you're messed up. And that's true. But, there's some ways that, with God's help, you are supposed to transcend that and overcome that.
Tim, I'll let you take the first crack at that. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, his weird dodge about the Old Testament doesn't use this word nature. I haven't dug into it. I was just starting to pull up my Bible software to start digging around on this. In some ways, the Greek language, is quite different than the Hebrew language. And you shouldn't expect to see one-to-one. I was going to go back and look and see where and how this word pops up in the Greek translations of the Old Testament that you get, a few decades before Jesus. But, it's a weird dodge. And because the New Testament certainly talks about it, and, famously or infamously, Romans 1, Paul talking about homosexuality being against nature.
Yeah.
And nature, biblically, not just being a way of describing the way things are, but also a way of describing what things are moving toward and what they should be.
Yeah.
And in some ways, this raises the million-dollar question: what is our purpose? Is our purpose to endlessly upgrade ourselves by way of technology? And God just says, "Well, as long as you upgrade yourself somehow or evolve yourself somehow, that's all good." It is interesting that he says that we're naturally fallen. I mean, in some ways, that's true theologically, at least as we exist now and the world exists now. But sin is not proper to who we are, there's nothing essential to humanity about sinfulness. Jesus was not sinful, but he was the most human who's ever lived. And one day, you know, there will be, you know, untold millions and billions and trillions of people who will not be sinful. God will graciously redeem them from sin, but they will still be human, and they'll be in many ways more human than they are now. You know, there is a funny thing. I mean, you popped up this article by him from First Things, something about against Edenism, and the first line was something about the future is not going to be like the past. I don't know what he's getting at in that article, but especially within Reformed Protestant theology, there's an emphasis on the state of redemption, not just being a return to the Garden of Eden, but a transcendence of it. That Adam and Eve, by rebelling against God, lost their upgrade, so to speak, to something that would have been much better than what the Garden of Eden was. I think a lot of Christians, you know, they kind of think, oh yeah, you know, heaven is just going to be like going back to the Garden of Eden. Actually, it's something better than what Adam and Eve had in the Garden of Eden. And so there is a sense in which Peter Thiel is kind of onto something of, hey, we will move on to something greater, but the million-dollar question is how you do that, and what exactly will it be? Is it just a matter of technological power and knowledge? No, I think far more than knowledge or power, although we'll certainly know more, and I think we'll be a lot more powerful. Much more than those things, it is about wisdom. It is about knowing God. It's about seeing God. It's about being with God, far more than it is about our capabilities as a species, you know, supposedly evolving into something better.
Yeah, there's a famous like contemporary Christian music musician named Phil Wickham, and he's got a song where the chorus is basically like, I want it. It goes like, I want it like it was back then. I want to be in Eden, and like it's this whole, it's like a really sappy song. But the kernel of truth there is, I want to be with God. I want to have unbroken fellowship with God. Ooh, great. Like, we're with you. Like, that's great. At the same time, to your point, there's a number of theologians who basically are saying, like, God's prohibition, just like most of God's prohibitions, the prohibition of taking the fruit was not a forever prohibition. It was a temporal prohibition. And once they passed the test, God's, you know, role, God's design for them and desire for them was that at some point when they reached maturity, they would take the fruit and they would, you know, join him. And there's a, you know, an understanding that is something that will happen, you know, at the end. We will be with God in a garden. We'll have unbroken fellowship with him. But it is really interesting to try to think that that's something to be obtained by oneself rather than that being something that is attained for us by Jesus, which I think is what the Orthodox Christians, small o Orthodox Christians, would say.
I mean, in the Garden of Eden, right after they sin, he's like, we got to get them out of here so they can't take the tree of life and continue in this state forever. In some sense, it would be a horrible judgment, right? Like allowing us to die is almost like a mercy. Transhumanism is at its core trying to get around this curse and around this limitation that God's put on us. We have a limited number of years. They would couch it sort of in the language of, oh, it would be so horrible if, you know, intelligence or consciousness got snuffed out. But really, they just want to live forever and they want to do it on their own terms. And so it's at odds with Christianity. It's a religion, basically. If you don't believe in an afterlife, most of these people are atheists. It sounds like Peter has some sort of belief in at least part of what the Bible says. But most of the people that are wrapped up in it are pretty staunch atheists, or at least agnostic. And so they're turning to the transhumanism to be immortal. He said it himself.
Is it Brian Johnson? Who's that creepy guy?
Brian Green, maybe?
Trying to live forever.
Yeah, like sucking his son's blood. Like, real weird stuff going on there.
Well, I mean, the Pope of transhumanism is Ray Kurzweil. You know, he's the guy that's talking about the singularity all the time. And that's where AI comes into things, right? Because it's like, essentially, and this is why Elon's doing Neuralink, is they kind of view AI as creating the next version of intelligence, and it'll be godlike. And the only way for us to continue on with it is to be able to merge with it somehow, with our intelligence. And I just don't see this at all. I mean, Christianity basically says we're going to have new bodies and a new heaven and a new earth. And that's how it's going to be. We're going to be humans. Jesus is a human still. He's got a real body sitting at the right hand of God the Father right now. So,
yeah. It's just, again, I really think that's an important thing here is like, I mean, as Christians, it's not that we don't see, you know, like there, it's not that there aren't issues or aren't problems that need to get dealt with, but you know, God has ways and God has means. God has manner. He has ways of dealing with these things and he has a timeline. And so again, this is related to my,
it's pretty clear that God doesn't want us to create our own immortality. That's the whole point of Jesus dying on the cross for us.
Correct. Yeah, correct. And then, and then on top of that, like so much of this, again, we could just bring it back to like Bitcoin stuff. Like so much of this is only possible because you have effectively unlimited money that's created out of thin air to pursue all of these insane things. Like if we actually had scarce money, you know, there wouldn't be just all of this money just to play with. You know, it's this coming at great sacrifice to future generations of, again, ironically, it's similar to the Brian Johnson thing, like, right? Like this is God intended parents to lay down their lives for children. And like the nature of sin in so many ways is basically forcing your children to die for you. Like this is one of the problems with abortion is a functional, you make your child die so that you can live, you know, whatever life you want. Brian Johnson literally is making his son give him his blood and platelets so that he can rejuvenate himself. It is a very, you know, spiritual, it's a very spiritual thing that's happening, spiritual in a negative way. But yeah, these are religious actions. This is dogma. There's a whole eschatology that's built in here, which is like an understanding of how things are going to end, in pursuit of those things. So yeah, we're getting into some wild space here.
Okay. Well, I have a question for you guys. So, you know, human progress in technology raises all kinds of ethical questions. Bavinck, he's a theologian that I like a lot. He talks about how one thing that makes humans unique, with relationship to angels on the one hand or animals on the other hand, is that there is a sense in which humans develop and they progress while still remaining essentially human. You know, in other ways, we are quite different than people who lived thousands of years ago, technologically, culturally, socially. In some ways, you know, Bavinck talks about, you know, part of the human mandate from Eden onward is to endlessly kind of unfold God's creation and bring it into greater and greater conformity to him and increasing kind of reflection of his image and his character. You know, you could take that in some really weird ways and go the Peter Thiel route of, you know, therefore, you know, just let it rip and, you know, any kind of progress is therefore fine. But, you know, sometimes I've heard people push back and they say, well, okay, so there's things Christians are not supposed to do, or humans are it's off limits for them and you shouldn't be playing God. You know, what about a pair of glasses? You know, you are improving your vision. You're fixing your eyes, so to speak, by means of technology. Are you refusing to submit to God as your eyes start to degrade if you get a pair of glasses? How would you guys help people navigate these questions of where's the line between playing God? You know, say, you know, we all kind of know there's probably a line somewhere of like, hey, you just need to let yourself die at some point ethically instead of endlessly doing whatever you can to extend your life. But there's a lot of things that we do that probably too many of our ancestors would look like, wow, you guys are really playing God. And, you know, like, you know, we were just talking about somebody who's gone through this crazy bone marrow transplant, this kind of resurrection-like experience of having all of your bone marrow reboosted somehow. But I don't know, how do you guys help people navigate that in terms of what's playing God, what's not? What does it look like to submit to God, say, especially around issues of the end of life?
You want to jump in or you want me to jump in?
Go for it, Jim.
I mean, there's like kind of two categories in my mind. One is sort of more of a relative idea of how much of your resources and how much of your time and energy are you having to expend to sort of do this thing? Obviously, we have technologies available to us today that are unimaginable even just 100 years ago. They're just totally commonplace. Like we're just going to eat some penicillin or whatever and it'll knock out the bacteria inside of us and we don't get an infection and we don't die and it costs nothing. So I think that's fairly straightforward. Like, yeah, sure, go ahead and do it. But it's like, if you're sitting on $3 million of retirement savings or something, and you're just going to burn the whole account down so you can live another 6 or 12 months, that's probably not the best use of those resources for long-term generational kingdom-minded work. To get an extra 6 months, and if you're, especially if you're like bedridden, you have no quality of life. I mean, I don't know, maybe there's like special circumstances, but to me, it's like this continuum of something that costs next to nothing to it costs everything, right? The needle's got to be somewhere in between. And then the second category of things is what you're doing fundamentally changing the nature of what you are, or sort of how you think, or how your mental process works. I mean, even just the idea of like uploading your brain into a computer and then running it at 10,000 times speed. You know, it's like, so I, it's like, it's still me maybe somehow, even though I don't have a body, but now I'm able to live for 10,000 years in the same time that other people experience 1 year. Like, I think you sort of become, it dehumanizes you at that point. You can't really interact with other human beings anymore in any reasonable way. I mean, if you think about it, like if you're trying to record a podcast and you're this entity that runs its brain at 10,000 times faster than everybody else, like even just this string of sentences that I've been saying for the last 2 minutes would feel like 2 months to this thing. And at like, it just doesn't, you've become fundamentally and categorically like something different, right? And it's, I don't think that's what God intended for us to be. I do think there, when we get to the new heaven and the new earth and we get glorified bodies, we will feel more human than we've ever felt. And when we look back at like what it was like to live as humans in this world and under sort of the reign of sin, we'll look back and just feel like, man, we were only like 1% humans. Like, this is what it's really like to be a human, you know? And there'll be like some sort of vibrancy to it. It's like we were living in black and white and now we're living in color. I think C.S. Lewis has a lot of these analogies in his books. So I think if you're sort of like trying to turn the dials on that and change something with respect to like space and time and how fast you can run and how intelligent you are, and things sort of become orders of magnitude different than where you're currently at, you have crossed some sort of line. Having said that, like if Elon comes out with the Geordi visors and I can see infrared spectrum or something like that, I don't know. I think that's pretty cool. I'm cool with that. Like, or restoring people's vision. Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I think the thing where I guess where I would start, there's a couple ways that I would parse this. Tim, would this be considered casuistry, or is that something slightly different?
I don't know. It depends what kind of casuistry we're talking about. Sometimes it's fun and sometimes it's crazy.
Yeah. So basically casuistry is basically trying. Yeah. It's like trying to apply ethical principles, like trying to apply, you know, biblical principles to ethics as far as I'm understanding. And you're basically trying to like triangulate what is okay to do in certain situations. The topic of ethics is like super fascinating to me. It has become fascinating in the past few years. Oliver O'Donovan, I don't know if you're familiar with any of his work. If you're watching at home and ethics interests you, go grab Oliver O'Donovan. He's written a ton of books. He's an Anglican guy, one of the most respected political philosophers today. And so I think like, one of the first question that I would ask is like, am I sinning? Like in trying to figure out, should I pursue something? So in the case of, in the case of the person who's, needs glasses or whatever, how should I think about, should this person just be content with their lot in life? God has given them this weakness. Should we just tell them to be content with that? I think there's reason to believe no. One of the reasons would be, I mean, for example, Luke was a physician. God heals, like God frequently heals people. He recognizes that in a sinful world, there's consequence to that, and yet God overcomes them. And one of the ways that we can be like God is by, you know, imitating him in these ways, by using things that are in his world and in, you know, manipulating them, working them, to be able to help people. I think the big governing principle of this would be, again, so to say it negatively would be, am I sinning? To state it positively, it would be, am I loving God and am I loving my neighbor? Is the way that I'm both what and how I'm considering acting in alignment with the priorities and the ways that God has laid out that he wants people to act? So in the case of transhumanism, you're having to get, in order to do this, so much of this is based on, you know, so much debt. A lot of these guys are getting, you know, getting, they have all these stock and like, there's all this debt that's based in, you know, they're enabled to do all these things because they're able to get so much debt and they have so much money that's built on debt. They leverage themselves. Elon's doing this. So the reality of this is that by getting to, in order to get this kind of debt, you fundamentally have to steal. And so there's a large extent to this where I would say, well, a lot of this is just ruled out because the only way it's possible is because you're stealing. You shouldn't have the ability to do the things that you're considering because you don't have the resources to do them. So am I sinning? That'd be one thing. The positive framing would be, am I loving God and am I loving my neighbor? So the question would be, why do you want to do what you're going to do? If you're trying to fight off death, because you're for yourself, to the example that Jim talked about, where you have $3 million, you've got family, whatever, you think that all things being equal, you're probably going to die within 6 months. You can either blow all that money to try to, you know, make some last ditch effort to survive, or you can, you know, die in 6 months and then leave that to them, leave that to, you know, gospel ministry, leave that to whatever. If the reason why you're pursuing whatever it is because of fear, or because of trying to, you know, you're afraid of, you know, whatever, sinfully afraid, you're trying to avoid death, you're trying to, you know, whatever it is, that's actually an indication you shouldn't be doing it. I think that'd be one thing. Now, on the other hand, again, if you're sitting here and you're a physician and you see this person who's struggling, they can't see, and you're thinking, man, I want to love my neighbor. I want to care for this person. I have these resources. What can we figure out about the eye? What can we figure out how to use the things that God has created? And just coming in with the presupposition that God intends us to take the things that he's made and transform them in ways that do honor and serve him and do honor and love our neighbor. I think like some of these presuppositions can actually lead you to basically want to and have the expectation and the presupposition that within the world, God has put things that are there to be transformed and can be used to be a blessing to people, to alleviate suffering in a number of different ways.
There's a comment in the chat. God doesn't want us to live long, healthy lives, but rather short lives with diseases. I don't think that's what we're saying. Tim, do you want to address that one?
No, I think what we are saying is that God has, everything we do is ultimately under God's authority, and that God has kind of delegated his responsibility to us, but there are strict limits. Tolkien, in his famous lecture on fairy tales, says basically the kind of the heart of the fairy tale is the ban, the prohibition. There are certain things that you must not do, and most fairy tales revolve around people crossing that line or bumping up against it somehow. And again, this is why we're talking about this. There is a wisdom. There's a lot of wisdom needed. There's a lot of gray areas here. What is the line between the kind of improvement in life that God blesses and commands that Christians of all people should be deeply interested in improving life for their neighbors? That's what Jordan's talking about, of how do I make things better for people?
Yeah.
In the same way that God does that for us and gives those things to us. But at the same time, there is a line somewhere where you can't try to become God by defeating death. Only God can defeat death ultimately, and all of us will die. There's no escape from death. And what we're concerned about with the Peter Thiel stuff is that I think technology and computers and AI and space travel and all these things can give us the illusion that we now have the ability to defeat things that humans have never defeated. But almost certainly this will lead to much worse outcomes, and God will, if nothing else, pull a Tower of Babel and foil our plans, and it'll be much worse than it was. I mean, there's a lot of this in Tolkien, there's a lot of this in C.S. Lewis, kind of human hubris, trying to fly really close to the sun, so to speak, leading to disaster. And I think there is an element of, especially around kind of end-of-life questions, there is an element of submitting to God and accepting what he has given you, and accepting that we are sinful and fallen. Even if as Christians we are redeemed and forgiven, there is still a profound frailty to life, and a weakness, and death at the end of all of it, as something that God, even as Christians, still calls us to submit ourselves to instead of endlessly fighting against it. But that doesn't mean death's a good thing, suffering's a good thing. We should all just be happy to suffer and die. No, of course not. Biblically, you lament suffering, you lament death, you hate death. Jesus wept, you know, bitterly at the tomb of his friend Lazarus. Mm. Jesus was terrified in the Garden of Gethsemane to go to the cross. Mm. But ultimately, with Jesus, you learn to say, you know, not my will, but yours be done. And death, like Martin Luther says, for the Christian, death becomes your friend because it's the gateway to paradise, even though it's still terrible and it's awful.
And yeah, that's what I would answer, how I would answer Sopranos fan 11, is like God wants to, you know, he will deliver us from suffering. He does not want suffering. And so for the Christian, death does, you know, it is a gracious thing where God allows suffering to end. And then we, you know, we enter into his presence and we get to be with him and are delivered from suffering. Another thing further, maybe complicating this a little bit, is that God does both seemingly design certain things. He designs things and permits things to be used in ways in suffering that maybe he wouldn't under normal circumstances. So one of the things, obviously, there's tons of prohibitions against drunkenness in scripture. This is, you know, clear. Like we should not live in wanton drunkenness. This is not good. And yet in the Proverbs, we basically hear that, like, you know, wine is for the suffering. Like, this is, you know, one of the benefits of drunkenness is that, like, it can help somebody who's in desperate pain. It can help numb some of that pain for them. That's obviously a means to this larger end. That's a desire. The goal is to love your neighbor and help them, you know, face these last days and minimize their suffering. At the same time, this is why we're Christians, we don't, you know, fight against pain medications or, you know, things like this. But I still think it can be a slippery slope for people who are like, see, here's this thing that's used in an illicit way. And that's a justification for wanting to, you know, for something. That an analogy would be, that I think would be more clear to the average Christian, would be the kind of thing that we're objecting to is basically the kind of thing that basically looks at, that looks at aborted babies and says, hey, look, if we keep aborting all these babies, then we can have all of these stem cells, which we can do all kinds of really good things with. And so it's a version of sinning that grace may abound. Like, look, we're gonna continue to abort babies. We're gonna kill small children, and then we're gonna use their bodies for good. We're gonna basically devote these, and then people who are alive will be able to benefit from their deaths. And that will give us a net benefit to humanity. And so it's worth doing. Like, that's the kind of illicit, you know, sinful ends justify the means thinking that I think we're trying to get at.
I'll just add, I've lived through many, many years of debilitating chronic pain, like to the point where you can hardly even roll over in bed without just being in agony. And first of all, those are some of the closest times I've ever felt to the Lord, as sort of counterintuitive as that sounds. And then the verses, like in Colossians, you know, this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory, just becomes so vivid in that moment, in that context, because you just realize, as humans living here and now, it just feels like this is never going to end, and this is all there is, and our life is so long, and the suffering is so unbearable. And then you just remind yourself of these promises and the fact that we are going to, you know, Jesus went to prepare a room for us in his Father's house. And for the vast majority of our existence as immortals, God created us as immortal. We are immortal. We will be in this glorified body. It's almost just even too hard to comprehend when you think about a trillion years in the future, having lived trillions of years effectively, trying to think back to this time where we live 70, 80 years, maybe. It's just like this tiny little sliver of our existence. It's almost even hard to believe that we'll be able to remember it at all, you know? So I don't know. I just take great comfort in that, in those moments. Yeah, we're destined for glory, guys. Like this, I love being alive, and I love seeking after God's will for like what it is that we're supposed to be doing here and now. He has us here for a reason, but this is transient. And in the words of Janet Yellen, this is transient, man.
All right, we've got one more teal clip we have to show, and then we can move on. Let's see here. I believe it is this one, talking about where Peter starts talking about the Antichrist.
This is my very specific question for you, right? Is that, well, you're an investor in AI. You're deeply invested in Palantir, in military technology, in technologies of surveillance, and technologies of warfare, and so on, right? And it just seems to me that when you tell me a story about the Antichrist coming to power and using the fear of technological change to sort of impose order on the world, I feel like that Antichrist would maybe be using the tools that you were building, right? Like, wouldn't the Antichrist be like, great, you know, we're not going to have any more technological progress, but I really like what Palantir has done so far, right?
Yeah,
I mean, isn't that a concern? Wouldn't that be the irony of history would be that the man publicly worrying about the Antichrist accidentally hastens his or her arrival?
There are all these different scenarios. I obviously don't think that that's what I'm doing. I don't think that's
what you're doing either. I'm just interested in how you get to a world willing to submit to permanent authoritarian rule.
Well, but again, there are these different gradations of this we can describe, but is this so preposterous, what I've just told you, as a broad account of the stagnation that the entire world has submitted for 50 years to peace and safetyism? This is a 1 Thessalonians 5:3. The slogan of the Antichrist is peace and safety, because we've submitted.
This is,
yeah. So, yeah, I can guarantee you that you were not expecting a Thessalonians reference, but man, Peter just lives to please, man. He loves throwing us theological catnip. Please, Tim, make sense of that for us.
Well, I mean, I think to his point, there can be different flavors of peace and safety. You know, this is kind of like the 1984 account of the world versus the Brave New World account of the world of totalitarianism. There is a strong kind of outwardly very masculine brute force form of totalitarianism, you know, that comes with its own promise of peace and safety in 1984, Big Brother, you know, crushing your face forever and ever. Mm-hmm. Or there's this more kind of feminine, maternal, nurturing form of totalitarianism that comes through technological, you know, peace and safety. And, you know, we'll kind of make sure everyone breathes correctly and we all have our drugs and our sex and our entertainment. And, you know, in a lot of ways, our world looks a lot more like the latter, Brave New World. You know, it looks like a lot more likely, at least in the West, that people would be kind of allured by technological progress and ease and comfort. I think they're both dangerous. Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can promise peace and safety through the strong man or through, you know, the nanny state.
Yeah.
But they're both huge problems and dangers, and both of them, you know, to use the word Antichrist, something that stands in the place of Christ. You know, only Christ can be Christ. And Jesus warns, he says, yeah, in the last days, watch out. A lot of guys are going to come in claiming I'm the Christ. And, you know, obviously that was happening a lot in the first century around the destruction of the temple, but there's an element of that kind of, there's all kinds of ways that people come promising to be the Messiah. Elon Musk says, you know, my way is the messianic way forward. And as Sam Altman says, no, my way is the messianic way forward. And it's like, I think as Christians, we're called to be wary of all of it.
This is the classic technologist take. They've got hammers and everything is a nail. It's the same thing happens in Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the ultimate hammer and all the world's problems are nails. So it's no different.
Are you guys familiar with Slavoj Žižek?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so he's like a philosopher. He's a slovenly mess of a man. But his last name is spelled Z-I-Z-E-K. But one of the things he talks about is basically, he just basically says something to the effect of, listen, we can learn, us atheists can learn a lot from the Christians. They've done lots of good things and really cool things, and we should imitate them. And so, this is one of the things where it's like, and again, Peter's not an avowed atheist. But I mean, just looking at, you know, to look at the world and just to try to just look at Christianity and just like, all right, we're going to pluck out these things. And then we're just going to just try to copy paste them into our own, you know, our own conception of the world here. This actually, it's proof texting. It's like, we're going to find this verse and then, ooh, this suits Palantir. This suits Palantir's purposes. Here, we can just quote this one. It's just wild to hear scripture being quoted. Very, very weird. Very odd days that we're in. It's super interesting, the world in which we're living in, where people are trying to reconcile with their own brokenness, trying to reconcile with a world in flux, and trying to figure out how to make sense and order it. And again, to some degree, recognizing that that is part of what God wants to do, but doing it in hermeneutical approach that I think is horrifying. So hopefully we can get Peter some better theology and help him kind of make sense of Thessalonians better. Tim, have you ever preached through Thessalonians?
I never had. Well, to just all the weird eschatology stuff is like, I don't know. That's tricky.
Tim, you're born for such a time as this. Let's go. We just need to start preaching through Thessalonians. Well, we actually do have we have shockingly a few different connections to Peter Thiel, if you can believe that. I know like three different people who are literally friends of Peter Thiel. So it's potentially possible for us to actually get at them. So that might be something we should do, maybe. Was not expecting Antichrist talk either. That was wild. Anyhow, guys, wild things are happening. God opens up opportunities for us to talk about all kinds of stuff. Let's keep moving here. The next thing we have, Tim, this is one that you shared. Let me, it's a PresbyCast. Who would have seen this one coming that you guys would share this? I'll let you tee this up.
Okay, PresbyCast. I just thought this was interesting. This guy is he's a ruling elder in the PCA, or some people call these guys lay elders. This just made me think of a lot of people I know in kind of Bitcoin world. He says, a warning and encouragement for those returning to Christianity in the last several years, you know, with a nod to some of these guys like Peter Thiel or Joe Rogan or guys like that who are interested in Christianity, but are maybe missing what it's really about. He says, the normal trajectory for the faithful is to find a settled home in a local church. Finding online affinity groups being based or heavily newly radical political social views is not enough. A new taste for singing psalms as opposed to praise jingles, aversion to seed oils, becoming woke about Israel or race or whatever. None of these things are the fruit of the spirit. If your spiritual journey does not end in the sometimes boring or horrors of borderline boomerish local church, you may still be on the wrong road. I just thought that there's a good amount of wisdom in that. And this is kind of one of my little hobby horses, is trying to encourage Bitcoiners to just embrace the kind of normie boringness of being a Christian and of the local church for all the things that may frustrate you about the church and frustrate me about the church. Jesus loves the church and died for it. And local churches are wonderful. And we all like Bitcoiners. We like hanging out with Bitcoiners because, you know, it's hard when everyone thinks you're insane and people get excited to come across other Bitcoiners. But you should be deeply involved in a local church, as frustrating as it may be, because it's wonderful. And God does so much for us through people who are different than you and have different perspectives and different experiences and different generations. It's just a beautiful, wonderful thing. So yeah, I don't know. I just like the way he said that. I think sometimes people can get a little too kind of fixated on certain aspects of Christianity, especially Christian ethics and, oh, this thing about following Jesus or this thing about God's law is, it's so based and it's so cool. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, we should be excited about that. But, you know, most of all, you know, do you love Christ? You know, is he a priority in your life? You know, are you knowing him more and more and more? And obviously a lot of that can be way overdone emotionally or kind of sentimentally in terms of, you know, this kind of Jesus, my boyfriend, mega churchy stuff. But like, you know, you never ever get beyond knowing Christ and drawing closer to him and delighting in him as a Christian. This is the whole point. This is going to be the best thing about heaven, is not that there's no fiat and no sin and that all your buddies will be there. But the best thing about heaven is that Christ is there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, reflecting that now in your life. And if the church is the body of Christ with all of its failures and its sins, and then you should be deeply invested in the church and love the church.
Yeah, you should definitely be going to church. But then also the flip side is you don't have to be like some super Christian missionary to Uruguay or something, you know, to like, to get into heaven.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think, go ahead.
I was going to say, Jim and I were recently talking about this famous Dietrich Bonhoeffer quote. He is a famous Lutheran pastor in the 30s, resisted Hitler.
Tried to kill him.
In prison because of trying involved in a plot to kill him. Got executed right before the end of the war. But he has this little book on Christian community, and you know, Bonhoeffer had some weird stuff theologically, but you know, one of his famous lines from this book on Christian community is about how the person who loves their idea of community more than the community itself destroys the community.
Mm.
And I don't know, it's not just a Bitcoiner problem. It's a, you know, a problem among all kinds of very zealous, motivated, idealistic people. But yeah, this idea of what you think the church should be, or what Christian community should be, and you just kind of end up becoming just frustrated and jaded and just a complete pain in the rear end to everybody around you instead of just accepting your boring, normal, sinful community that God's given you.
Yep. That book is Life Together. I remember reading that quote and it just was like, you know, it was just wild. Just such a timely word. I do think as well, I mean, the reality is, again, if you are a new Christian, you ought to think about, no matter how clearly you think you see things, like you ought to think about yourself as a child, like you're a child spiritually. And the reality is that children need older people. And so there's a real sense both that you, whether you recognize it or not, you need older people. You need people who've walked with the Lord for longer. God, there's tons of scriptures that talk about the wisdom of the age, the wisdom of the you know, the gray hair. You know, there's tons of, you just need wisdom and experience. On top of that, those aged people and people who've walked with the Lord longer need you. Like they need, like God works. The way that he works is like we all can encourage each other. And so the fact, like if you're some random Bitcoiner who found yourself becoming a Christian, like there are churches that need reminders that God just plucks people out of, God has normal ways. The normal way is, you know, you grow up as a kid and you hear the scriptures and you come to trust in Jesus and you grow up, and that's God's normative way. But God definitely works. Still just saves people out of seemingly nowhere. And so like just the reminder of that and the encouragement that comes from, you know, your testimony. In the book of Revelation, it talks about basically the saints overcame by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. Like this is a powerful thing. And so like there's a real sense in which you need others, and there's a sense in which others need you. And so you need to see God working in others. You need to have a sounding board for the struggles that you're having. These are all really, really important things. And, just to mock or just don't think you need a church that doesn't seem as based as, you know, you wish that it would be is just a huge error. So, yeah, good word. Appreciate that, Tim. Now, okay.
Should we address the elephant in the room? I mean, Bitcoin is absolutely ripping right now.
I'm not even paying attention.
Yeah, we're almost to 116.5 now.
Oh my gosh.
So
I'm looking at, oh my gosh. Okay. Well, hooray.
I mean, it's great. Crazy. I don't know. Somehow the Lord is putting on my heart to just like get this off my chest right now. Please do not ape him with tons of leverage right now. Just please don't do it. Like, don't do it. Like, it's great. Bitcoin's going up. We all want it to go up, but like, just don't do it.
Yeah. Amen.
Go touch grass, as the kids say these days.
Go touch grass, eat some ribeyes, go to the lake.
Don't smoke grass.
All right. Now, again,
unless you're in searing pain.
In speaking to other timeless wisdom, let's check out a tweet from James Wood. It's almost always a good thing to do. Just go find a James Wood tweet.
On your podcast with your bros, you need some tweets. Just go dig into James Wood and
Into James Wood. You're probably going to find lots of Augustine. Speaking of people who go find wisdom from the ages, James is a friend. He's, again, we keep finding ourselves surrounded with Presbyterians. James, let's see what James has to say. Tim, this is yours. I'll let you do it. Go for it.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, so I just saw this. James Wood, I think he's writing a book right now on St. Augustine. And this is a 5th century bishop and pastor in North Africa. He had this quote. One here you're showing us is a response to a guy. He had this quote where he basically says, hey, why does God allow for there to be good kingdoms and bad kingdoms in the world? We all hope and pray for good, godly kingdoms submitted to Christ and doing his will. But, most people for most of history have lived under very bad kings and kingdoms. And, there's a lot of things about our political environment now that are terrible and regrettable and awful and cause all kinds of suffering for people. So James Wood put this quote from Augustine, why does God allow that? And he basically said, he wants to continually train people not to yearn for these things in the sense of putting your ultimate hopes in them, that this is what life is all about. It's about ease and comfort and prosperity in this world. Some guy replied to him and said, no, that's dumb. It's a good thing to want to have a godly, good political rule in this world. And James Wood basically wrote back and said, no. Of course, no one's saying that that doesn't matter. But we need to, I thought this was interesting in the middle of this page. Augustine also recognizes how fragile and unstable these arrangements are at this time. God raises up a Constantine, and for the Anabaptists in the room, James Wood thinks that's a good thing. But he also raises up a Julian, Julian the Apostate, Roman Emperor. Augustine calls us to relate properly to these goods, real goods. It's a good thing to have a good king and a good political situation. But I thought this was good. We need to hold them somewhat loosely without losing our firm hope in the full and permanent realization of our desires, even political desires, in the eschaton, in the age to come, in the redemption of all things, which in some ways are partially experienced now in the church as kind of a foretaste of the new creation to come. So anyways, just another reminder to all of my Bitcoiner friends out there, whether you're a Christian or not, having things work out economically and socially and politically in this world is a good thing. We should try our best to aim for them, but ultimately they will disappoint us and they will be frustrated in all kinds of ways. And our ultimate hope is in the age to come.
The eternal weight of glory.
Beyond all compare. Yeah. I think looking at even sufferings, Jim, you were talking about looking at sufferings as a gift and as something for you to steward, something that is pointing you somewhere. I think it's also helpful to think about political situations in that way as well. Like Paul talks about, the Apostle Paul talks about like, if you have your freedom, use it. Like, don't seek to be enslaved again. Like, use your freedom to serve the Lord. He's not basically asking you to love your slavery or love your bummer situation that you're in, but he just basically is advocating. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris, yeah. Or if you're Bonhoeffer.
Yes.
Like, if you're Bonhoeffer, you can kill Hitler.
Right. So
we're good with killing Hitler, right?
And and to escape suffering. Suffering is not a good thing. No Christian should say death is wonderful or suffering is great or wonderful. But at the same time, we also recognize that we live under God's wise but often mysterious rule. And all of us can look back and you ask yourself, what were the times in my life when I drew closest to God, when I knew Christ the most?
Yep.
Well, probably, if I had to guess, 99 times out of 100, it wasn't the good times in your life. It was the bad times. It was the suffering.
Correct.
C.S. Lewis says somewhere, I think it's in his book on pain, that God whispers to us in our pleasures, but shouts to us in our pain.
Mm.
And you know, we wish that wasn't the case, but that's what we need. You know, we're dense and we're slow and we wander. God uses our pain to draw us back to himself. It's like Solzhenitsyn, you know, in Gulag Archipelago talks about being in the Soviet, you know, prison system, learning to love his cell, learning to thank God for it, because he realizes that if he had never been put into the concentration camps, he would have, you know, never become interested in God and mm. used to see the good of it. But, you know, at the same time, spends his entire life talking about how horrible it is and trying yeah. to get rid of it. But
shining
you
know, late on
history,
it.
How God uses suffering. Suffering is not good, but he uses it. I've sometimes wondered, you know, maybe one of the reasons that modern Western, especially Americans, are so, you know, profoundly depressed and unhappy and anxious and isolated in spite of all of their material affluence and financial affluence overall compared to the world and compared to history. Maybe in some ways this is baked into the cake of God allowing us to suffer so that we don't forget who mm. he is and how much we need him. You can fix things materially and economically and financially. I mean, I know we all think the financial system's terrible and it's awful, and it is, but in a lot of ways, most people in history would be happy to trade with us for our physical and our financial comforts that we have. But even so, we're a lot more unhappy than almost anybody who's ever lived. And I wonder if part of that is God kind of needling us and reminding us that you have not arrived and you won't arrive on your own. You need me.
Yeah, I really appreciate James. James, so there's this whole big conversation. We've talked about it like tangentially, and it'd be fun to do this in greater detail at some point. But just this whole people trying to reckon with what is the appropriate role of Christian thinking about nationalism, thinking about their citizenship here on Earth. Like, what does this look like? How much should we embrace it? And James has been a helpful voice. Another voice. This was not planned, but another voice has been Miles Smith. I think they are friends. And Miles shared basically this, kind of on the other end of the spectrum. He's quoting for a reading from one of David Platt's new books, apparently, that David Miles was not too big a fan of. So it says this claim from David Platt. So let's just read this. We'll kind of just skip down. It's the second to last paragraph. David Platt's, my contention in this chapter is simple. While many factors contribute to gospel poverty in jungles, villages, and megacities around the world, one of the primary reasons, if not the primary reason, that billions of people remain unreached by the gospel is that the global purpose of God has always faced resistance from the nationalistic people of God. So then Miles is his pushback here. This claim from David Platt that isolated tribes at all haven't heard the gospel because of nationalism is completely idiotic without regards to how one feels or defines or feels about nationalism. The Royal Navy did much to Christianize Africa as missionaries. This is, I mean, we could go a whole bunch of, go ahead.
I just said, uh-oh, you know,
yeah.
That's a bad word. Royal Navy.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, we're going to be, TGP is going to be releasing something that's tangentially related to this, but this is one of these things where they're like, nationalism is the boogeyman. It's like, it's the boogeyman right now. Everyone, it's just associated with, Hitler. That's the only possible, thing that you can have. Globalism is great. We won't look at any of the negative things that come with globalism. But we're just going to make nationalism, if you have any kind of love for your country, or if you think that it's anything other than completely adulterated bad thing, you're anti-Christian. And this is just so ridiculous. So, I don't know. This is, we could talk a lot more. Jim, I don't know if you have anything to add to this.
I can agree the Royal Navy did a lot to help.
Well, and yeah, again, I mean, it's kind of like what we were saying before. It's not to excuse or justify things that were genuinely sinful or caused all kinds of suffering. You know, okay, yeah, there's a lot of problems with imperialism, and you can look back, and it's easy to look back on your ancestors and dump on them and talk about how horrible they are. But it's like, at minimum, you can also say God used these things in history, you know, and then even more than that, you could say, actually, there was good things that they did, and it wasn't all bad. and to learn to appreciate that and recognize there's some nuance there, and it's not all 100% good, 100% evil. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's like, I will say, you know, probably most of us and most Christians, I mean, Jordan, you've been a missionary. I've been a missionary. Most of us probably do need to care more about the lost and do need to care more about the nations. And David Platt, I think, you know, is being very heavy-handed with kind of really laying on the guilt trip about how you big bad Americans, you don't do enough. But it's like, yeah, you know, there is a good reminder there of it's not just about us. And it's not just about like, well, I'm all good. So I don't know. I'm giving 1.5 cheers to David Platt. We probably should care more about evangelism and reaching the lost.
But that's not what he's saying. He's saying that the primary reason is because people don't want to share the gospel.
That's totally crazy.
Is because they're we love America too much. We're America is more important.
Quote that Will Smith had posted where David Platt says in this new book, you know, if you're not willing to move your entire family to the East,
you're
not a real Christian. And it's like
what?
Okay, no, that's not true. But Jesus does call a lot of us to do really hard things. Arguably all of us, you know, does it mean you have to go to Saudi Arabia to be a missionary? No, but I do think there is an element of like, yeah, following Jesus is hard and it's costly.
Yes. We 100% agree. Like this is, but to attribute like nationalism, like what he's aiming at is Israel in the Old Testament when they, you know, or like in, you know, Jesus's time where they hated the Gentiles and they didn't want the gospel to go to them I wouldn't even say that they didn't want to, because it was the Pharisees. And then, you know, some of the early church, there was confusion over, you know, what does this look like? What does the inclusion of the Gentiles look like? But to even describe that as being somehow, as if they were somehow hostile, I mean, Paul is going out and he's a missionary. He's sending other people on missions trips. Like this is an insane thing to say. This is, I mean, David Platt, come on, guy. This is just not good. All right. We can move on then from there. Miles, thank you. We'll be tagging you below. Maybe we can get some of these guys on the show. We can definitely hopefully get James at some point. Let's see. Where do we want to go from here? We've got Caitlin Long. I say we leave that one. Let's look at speaking of nationalism, let's look at a collapsing German Ponzi pension system. That's a great one. The threads write themselves here. Let me see here. This is Professor St. Ong, or Ange, something. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Germany's pension Ponzi is collapsing, and America is not far behind. The warning comes from one Thomas Colby, Zero Edge, who notes that Germany's pension scheme is already out of money, sustained only by annual 123 billion euro infusions from the federal budget. That's a quarter of Germany's federal budget. So in U.S. terms, it's like transferring an annual $1.5 trillion to Social Security's hole. The problem is Germany has a so-called pay-as-you-go pension system, meaning they spent all the surpluses in the first couple decades, the buildup of the Ponzi. Then when it hits zero, they have to plug the hole from current taxes. By the way, American Social Security works exactly the same way, with our zero point set to hit in about 8 to 10 years. But it's already hit in Germany for three reasons: a shrinking workforce, Germans aren't having babies, soaring government spending driven by low-income welfare-gobbling migrants, along with massive increases in military spending, and third, suicidal green energy policies destroying the jobs and economic growth that pays for it all. So Germany has just 46 million workers, but has 21 million pensioners. That's growing by about 500,000 a year. In other words, there's just two workers for every retiree in Germany. As for spending, migrant unemployment benefits alone cost about $200 billion a year in U.S. terms. Throw in remedial schooling, many of them can't read, free housing, and free healthcare, and that could double. On top, NATO members just pledged to triple military spending to pacify Trump, which would cost Germany, again in U.S. terms, hundreds of billions per year. Meanwhile, the German economy has been limping at just 1.2% growth for a decade now, thanks to massive overregulation and a government that takes half of GDP. Industrial output is actually below what it was in 2013. It nosedived in 2020, when Germany effectively banned fossil fuels and nuclear, shutting down generation plants one by one. So far, they have shuttered nearly 14% of power generation. This has nearly tripled energy prices, which destroyed productivity in energy-intensive manufacturing like steel and cars. It's now 20% below where it was in 2019. Manufacturing lost 120,000 jobs in last year alone. U.S. terms, that's like losing 500,000. This all matters because Donald Trump is doing everything he can to lure German industry to the U.S., along with their 5.5 million jobs, with lower red tape and taxes, lower energy prices, and a big, beautiful tariff umbrella. So what's next? Brought to you by iTrust Capital. For now, Germany will keep popping up the Ponzi by hiking.
All right, there we go. So Peter is, he's outlining this problem. He's basically saying, hey, some of this is of our own making, right? Some of this, and this is where, again, there's people who just want to put this all in the hands of immigrants. Oh, we have so many immigrants. They're the problem. That's the only problem. We should just talk about immigrants all the time and be frustrated with them. And kind of what he's saying is, yeah, but you haven't been having kids. And so, you know, a lot of these populations, whether it's in the United States or around the globe, a lot of these places in Europe, they haven't been having kids. And so they don't have people to, you know, replace and be, you know, not even taxpayers, but just like to be working, to be contributing cogs of the wheel, basically for their, as far as they're concerned. This is a whole thing of like, you can choose your actions, but you don't get to choose your consequences. And, right.
In some ways it's like a national level picture of what we were talking about earlier with kind of the Peter Thiel. Oh, if we,
yep.
you can, therefore you should, and we can just kind of solve our way out of all these problems. And it's like, you ultimately hit reality and you hit math and you hit God ultimately. And they, you know, all these things are being done with great intentions, in the kind of, Chesterton says somewhere, you know, the problem with the modern world is that the Christian virtues have run mad. You know, we kind of overemphasize some Christian virtues at the expense of others, and you end up destroying yourself, even though you could look at it and say, oh, no, but we're all about compassion and empathy, and we're going to help the poor. And it's like, you know, that's a really sad thing, is that it ends up hurting the weakest and the poorest most of all. And, you know, this is why we're so excited about Bitcoin and trying to help people, especially, you know, savers and people who are trying to save for the future. Because it's like, these people will probably get their pensions, but it will be in printed worthless euros that they won't be able to buy anything with.
Yeah.
Nothing stops this train.
And with that, we will stop this pod. We are grateful for you guys. Thank you for taking part in episode 19 of To the Unknown Pod. We'll be back hopefully with Oshawa and the Island Boys on Tuesday. Again, if you're listening to this and you like what you're hearing and you'd like to hear more and you'd like to incentivize us to do more, one way that you can do that is by going and leaving reviews on Apple and Spotify. Those are the two most influential podcast sites. And then you can also like these live videos on YouTube. We are grateful
Peter,
for you all.
If you're listening, Jordan needs to finish this Kickstarter campaign.
That's right.
Another $600. Peter Thiel, come on.
Absolutely. Yes, Peter, actually, all you have to do is you could choose any of the tiers. And then once you get to checkout, you can actually choose to donate even more. So just feel free to throw a few hundred million at that. This will be a much better use than putting it towards Palantir. Jim will be much happier.
Jordan will get you a custom inscription on the Bitcoin blockchain to sign your book.
I would not. I would turn down hundreds of millions of dollars rather than put an inscription on Bitcoin blockchain.
That's a good question. We should talk about that next time. Is it worth, would you accept $100 million and do an inscription?
This is Satan standing on top of the temple telling Jesus to jump. You know, like, look at all the good that'll come.
I don't know if it's quite on that level.
Man does not live by inscriptions alone, for sure.
Anyhow, we are grateful for you guys. Jim, Tim, thank you guys. Go check out Magnolia.foundation. And see what they're doing. They're doing a lot of good work. We are grateful for you, and we'll see you in the next episode of To the Unknown Pod.